Welcome to the National Radio Club's DX Audio Service for October 2008. This is issue number 283. If you'd like to write to us at the DX Audio Service, the address is 706 McKenzie Drive, Lima, Ohio, 45805-1835. Telephone number is 360-382-1957. Email address, sales@nrcdxas.org. A subscription to the DX Audio Service for U.S. Canadian members is $28. To Europe and elsewhere, it's $40. Tapes are sent via first-class mail, and you keep your cassettes. To subscribe, make your check payable to the National Radio Club Incorporated and send them to me at the address that is mentioned, or log on to our website at www.nrcdxas.org and sign up using our PayPal credit card system. You can also sign up to EDXN and get your DX Audio Service on your computer or iPod player and stereo. A subscription to EDXN is only $15. Just point your browser to www.e-dxn.com and subscribe online with the PayPal credit card system, or contact Wayne Heinen at Post Office Box 473251, Aurora, Colorado 80047-3251 if you want to pay by check. Well, let's zip on down to Fort Worth, Texas, and talk to Mr. Bill Hale about that AM switch.
This is the AM Switch.
Thanks, Fred, and welcome again, everyone, to AM Switch for the DX Audio Service for October 2008. First off, as always, call letter changes on 580 Rockwood, Tennessee, WOFE is changed to WYHM. 780 in Monticello, Maine, the old WCXH is now WXME. They've got a CP coming from 710. On 910, WPTT Mount Lebanon, Pennsylvania has taken up the new call of WMNY. 950 in Denver, KKFN has changed to KRWZ. 990 in Rochester, New York, WRCI now calls themselves WDCX. 1140, KCLE in Cleburne, Texas, their new call is KHFX. 1200 WEMM Huntington, West Virginia, their new call WRWB. A new station in Middletown, New York on 1400 has taken WZCC as their call. 1400 WTCY Harrisburg, Pennsylvania has chosen WHGB for their call. 1460 KHFX Burleson, Texas, they've traded with that station in Cleburne, they're now KCLE. And finally, 1680 WDSS Ada, Michigan, their new call WPRR. Turning our attention now to construction permits, which have taken to the air over the past month. 670 KMZQ in Las Vegas, Nevada is now on. U4, two different patterns, 30,000 watts during the day, 600 watts at night. Their emanating signal comes from four towers, using three during the day and four at night. The main lobe of the day pattern shoots northwest, while the night signal goes southeast. 860 KMVP, Phoenix, Arizona. Their CP for U2, 940 daytime watts, 1,000 watts at night is now on, reducing that daytime power. 880 WZAB Sweetwater, Florida, CP for U4, 4,000 daytime watts. 5,000 watts at night is on from eight towers, using four during the day and all eight at night. The day pattern is pretty much balloon-shaped, headed northeast with a small bump headed to the northwest, while the night pattern shoots a long, slender lobe to the east-northeast with tiny lobes 90, 180, and 270 degrees off the main lobe. Sweetwater is a West Miami suburb. 1010 WPPI, Sauk Rapids, Minnesota, a construction permit for U4, 1700 watts during the day, 240 watts at night is now on from four towers, using two during the day and three at night. Different towers, of course, and their format is oldies. 1340 KSGT, Jackson, Wyoming. Their CP for this new station with a kilowatt day and night non-directional is now on. Also a new station, WTQS 1490, Cameron, South Carolina. They're on with 1,000 watts day and night non-directional. 1460 KBRZ, Missouri City, Texas. a CP4U1, 5,000 watts during the day, 125 watts at night is now on from a new transmitter site, a move of about 50 miles. The city of license changed from Freeport to also, and the FCC database reads Missouri as the city of license, but Missouri City is the actual name of the community. And 1550 WZNF Bonnell, Florida, CP for 8,700 watts during the day, 250 watts at night, U2, means night only directional, they're on from a pair of towers. The night pattern is a non-symmetrical figure eight with a lobe to the east and a smaller lobe to the west. Well, that's the best I can describe that one. Bonnell is on Florida's east coast, about 25 miles northwest of Daytona Beach. Some actions from the FCC and other agencies. 630 WMAL, Washington, D.C. Mid-Atlantic reporter Jerry Conkling reports that WMAL is painting their towers, and until the project is finished, they are operating at the reduced power of 2,500 watts non-directional days and their normal 5,000 watts directional at night. According to their special temporary authority granted by the FCC, the painting is being done between 8 and 5. Since their daytime pattern protects stations to the north, those living in Maryland, Pennsylvania, and maybe New Jersey may hear them during the day, as 2,500 watts on 630 should get out pretty good. The work should have concluded on about September 15th, so maybe by the time you hear this, the painting will be done. 780 KCEG Fountain, Colorado, a CP modification has been granted for this new station. The new facilities are 1,900 watts during the day, 720 watts at night, using two patterns. Our designation for that, U4. 1030 WCYV, Aurora, Indiana. A CP has been granted to move here from Greenville, Alabama on 1380. That's a long haul, Indiana from Alabama. The new facilities, D3, that's directional daytime only with 250 watts using two towers. They have pending modification and application for 500 watts daytime and 500 watts critical hours using two patterns. 1060 KRCN, Longmont, Colorado. A special temporary authority has been granted for non-directional daytime only, 12,500 watts, as the transmitter site was struck by lightning on or about August 12th. KRCN is now operating at the reduced power. They requested the STA to be in effect for 90 days, although new parts are expected within 60. 1140 KLTK, Centerton, Arkansas. A CP mod has been granted for 700 watts daytime non-directional, changing from 1,000 watts. 1170 KORL, Honolulu, Hawaii. A CP has been granted for 330 watts during the day, 140 watts at night, all non-directional. 1150 KRMS, Osage Beach, Missouri. CP has been granted for 840 watts daytime, 55 watts at night, moving to a new tower. 1350 KTIK, Nampa, Idaho. CP has been granted for a power upgrade during the day to 25,000 watts, remaining 600 watts at night, directional nighttime only. 1360 KBUY, Ruidoso, New Mexico. License for U1, 5,000 watts daytime, 199 watts at night. KBUY has a CP for 9,000 watts daytime, 182 watts at night. Now they've been granted an STA for 408 watts daytime only. The application for the STA states, and I quote, "The KBUY tower was destroyed when a backhoe hooked into one of the tower guy wires. Subsequent to the loss of its authorized antenna, station KBUY returned to the air at 6 a.m. Mountain Time on August 12th, employing an emergency long wire antenna at its licensed site. The antenna is elevated 25 feet and extends 102 feet in a northerly direction and 77 feet in an easterly direction." End of quote. No mention of nighttime operation, so we assume they are D1. 1500 WICY, Moores, New York, that's M-O-O-E-R-S. CP has been granted for daytime only directional operation of 50,000 watts, moving from 1490 in Malone. WICY will build a new four-tower array. The pattern will direct all of the signal due north. 1540 WWGK, Cleveland, Ohio. They've been granted D4, 3,000 watts during the day at 1,500 watts during critical hours. And that D4 means two different patterns. They are operating from a new two-tower site. Both patterns are directed due north, which will circle Lake Erie very nicely. 1590 WONX, Evanston, Illinois. A CP has been granted for U2, 7,000 watts during the day, 2,500 watts at night. The new night pattern is balloon-shaped, headed northeast. Going non-directional days was made possible by moving or taking dark several co- and adjacent channel stations in the Chicago and northern Illinois area. And also on 1590 WGBW, Denmark, Wisconsin, CP has been granted for 10,000 watts during the day, 200 watts at night, two patterns, that's U4, from four towers using all four day and night, changing its city of license from two rivers. The day pattern is a virtual circle headed north anchored at Denmark, while the night pattern sends a main lobe to the west-northwest and minor lobes to the east and south. Well, translator action. We've got a new category here. Some AM stations taking up FM translators. 1260 WCHV in Charlottesville, Virginia is now simulcast on W231AD, which is 94.1 megahertz. And 1440 WHDM, Mackenzie, Tennessee, has bought W255BF 98.9 with the intention of simulcasting the 1440 signal. Applications for new stations, 1370, Heflin, Florida, wants 250 watts day and night, directional nighttime. 1400, a new station has been applied for in Excel, Alabama, that's EXCEL. They want 1,000 watts day and night, non-directional. Also on 1400, Middleton, Idaho, has applied for 1,000 watts day and night, non-directional. And on 1450, Hellendale, California has applied for 250 watts day and night, non-directional. License cancellations and call letters deleted. 720 WQTH in Claremont, New Hampshire has been taken off the FCC books. This unbuilt station, approved way back in 1997, has had its latest request for extension to their deadline denied. The FCC says that, well, in a nutshell, 11 years is long enough to build. Some AM to FM conversions, all of these, of course, from Canada. 580 CKXR in Salmon Arm, British Columbia. As of 7:39 a.m., August 27th, Salmon Arm's AM 580 has been turned off, the end of a 40-plus year era. Now on 91.5 megahertz as Easy Rock. Repeaters are at Enderby on 104.3 and Sycamoose on 102.1. 780 CFDR, Dartmouth, Nova Scotia. They've applied to move to 92.9 with 100 kilowatts. 790 CIGM, Sudbury, Ontario, has applied for 93.5 with 100 kilowatts. 850 CKBA, Athabasca, Alberta, has applied to move to 94.1 with 9 kilowatts. 1280 CHQB, Powell River, Alberta, CFPW 95.7 has signed on, meaning CHQB has less than 90 days of life left. 1460 CJOY, Guelph, Ontario, has applied to move to 95.7 with 30 kilowatts. And a turn of events, which is kind of odd, coming from up north, the application of CFGT 1270 Alma, Quebec, to move to FM was denied by the CRTC, as it would result in the owner having three FM stations in the same market, which is against the CRTC regulations for commercial stations. Well, other items here and there returning to the airwaves over the past month. KDJQ 890 in Meridian, Idaho. They're back on with oldies. WCTN 950, Potomac Cabin John, Maryland. KDUN 1030, Reedsport, Oregon is back with oldies. And WALD 1080, Johnsonville, South Carolina is on with Black Gospel. Reported off, KNNZ 940, Cedar City, Utah. WOAP 1080, Owosso, Michigan. WQLS 1210, Ozark, Alabama. KMCL 1240, McCall, Idaho. WITM 1330, Marion, Virginia. WQOQ 1430 Durand, Wisconsin, and KSXT 1570 in Loveland, Colorado. Well, we're quoting a press release here, a new transmitter site for CFUN 1410 and its sister station CKST 1040 in Vancouver will be located on 104th Street between Highway 10 and Highway 99 in Delta. CFUN will go with a single directional pattern versus the current two, with improved nighttime coverage to the Fraser Valley and somewhat reduced coverage to the west side of Vancouver Island and Washington State. The prime coverage area to Metro Vancouver will not be drastically affected. The new site will consist of 7 self-supporting towers, which is a reduction of 1 tower from the present total made possible by the elimination of 1 pattern. This was done to allow for full agricultural production on the site once construction is completed. If guide towers had been used, 40% of the area would have been lost for farming. With self-supporting towers, only 2% of the area will be lost. The Agricultural Land Commission reviewed the proposal and in a unanimous decision allowed this proposal. Well, some fines to report, $3,000 to station WYRD 1330 Greenville, South Carolina for public inspection file violations, $18,000 to WLPO 1220 LaSalle, Illinois along with their FM station for public inspection file violations, and $9,000 to WRJX 1230 Jackson, Alabama, along with their FM, you guessed it, for public file violations. Well, that's about it for this month. My thanks go out to Frank Aiden, Sean Axelrod, Russell Curry, Wayne Heinen, Joe Kurth, Dean McIntyre, Patrick Martin, Dave Schmidt, and last but not least, because his name starts with a V and that's the end of the alphabet almost, Fred Vobey. Well, coming up next, John Bowker with this month's installment of the Travelogue. John?
Radio Club. Well, thanks very much, Bill Hale. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Travelogue for October. My goodness, it seems like we were just celebrating the summer. Say, I hope some of you got to the Pittsburgh Convention. What a wonderful time they had there. John Malachy really outdid himself, and there were so many things to do. I think you were kind of stretched in two directions. So, hats off to John Malachy for another very successful Pittsburgh Convention. On our 75th anniversary and, of course, the 250th anniversary of the city of Pittsburgh. So everything worked out just fine. And next year, oh, we're looking ahead, going back in eastern Pennsylvania. And we're going to be telling you more about that, of course, as the time moves on and as details get ironed out in the work. Well, anyway, the Travelogue is today's subject. We're going to be going through a part of the country that many of you have never been in. And we're going to start with a Midwestern city. I say that in quote marks, and we're going to end with one of the most historic cities in the history of broadcasting. Now, for today's travelogue, we're going to go back to 1995, and we're going to go down into the Cincinnati area, cross the Ohio River into Kentucky, climb the hill up by the big airport, and that leads us to the city of Covington, which, by the way, is considered in all of the encyclopedias a Midwestern city. Now, it's the only city in Kentucky that has that designation, but that's okay because if you go 1 mile south of Covington, you are considered in the Deep South. So we're going to go from there all the way to the Mississippi River today on the Travelogue, but let's start with our dial set at 1320 as we begin the October 2008 DX Audio Service Travelogue.
Inspirational sounds with Lee.
The station that cares, WCVG, Covington.
Here's the Greater Emmanuel Mass Choir with Everything's Gonna Be All Right. Be encouraged today.
Okay, very good. Now, you know, as I was assembling the program for this travelogue, it struck me that going from roughly the north middle part of Kentucky to the very western edge, there are 3 stations that we'll hear today at 1600 on the dial. The first one is here in Eminence, Kentucky, a city of 2200 or so.
You're on the right side of the dial, WKX, Eminence, Shelbyville.
Kentucky. Kentuckians can now buy affordable, guaranteed health insurance under the state's new Health Care Reform Act. Heather Braun has more.
Well, okay, we're going to have to pass on the details for this time around, but maybe next time, okay? Okay, we're going to come west down the Ohio River from the area around Cincinnati, and we come to another big city.
On the Kentucky News Network.
62 Country WTMT
Now, you got to tell me the truth. Am I the only one that has trouble hearing the announcer say Louisville? It's WTMT Louisville. Only, well, that's the big city I was getting to. Now, interesting, in the city of Louisville is another area called Newburgh. And up until 2003, Newburgh was a town unto itself. But in January that year, the city of Louisville took it over completely, and made it into nothing but a neighborhood. Still in all, the FCC lets this station identify with its city of license as Newburgh.
This is Headline News, a CNN network. This is CNN Radio, AM 680. WXKN, Newburgh to New Albany, Jeffersontown to Jeffersonville, Kentuckiana's all news and information station.
Headline News, I'm Toria Tolley, sitting in for Lynn Vaughn.
Well, thank you, Toria. We're going to move down now to the city of Frankfort, which is the state capital, on the Frank River. And by the way, it got its name from the ford across the Frank River. Well, you didn't care about that. But anyway, this station in the middle 1990s was at 1130 on the dial.
The station Kentucky's capital depends on for information. WKED, Frankfort.
CNN Radio News, I'm Tammy McCormick. Two Americans jailed for 4 months in Iraq say they're looking forward to seeing their families.
Now, the interesting thing to me is that that station, WKED, was at 1130 on the dial, a perfectly great frequency, but they've moved to FM, and nobody has picked up 1130 in Frankfort, Kentucky. And if we swing up the dial just a little bit in Frankfort, we come to another news authority station.
1490 WFKY, Frankfort, the news authority.
CBS News, I'm Bill Lynch. The number of heat-related deaths nationwide is now at least 222, but the total is expected to go higher. Chicago health officials say 300 deaths there may be tied to the heat wave.
And I wonder how many of us remember that heat wave. It went on for 8 days. It killed thousands of people. How quickly we forget. Well now, we're going to continue to the southwest along the beautiful Kentucky Parkway. It runs the whole length of the Commonwealth from east to west. And we're going to cross into the Central Time Zone for the first time today, just in time to pick up the 870 station in Litchfield, Kentucky.
All I do is dream about you. Living ain't a lot without
Grayson County's WMTL Litchfield.
From ABC News, I'm Doug Limerick. Another big trial gets underway in earnest shortly in Union, South Carolina.
Now, just a handful of miles north and west of Litchfield, Kentucky, is a little teeny town called Hartford, perhaps best known for two things. First thing is, Wyatt Earp's two brothers lived in Hartford and apparently whooped it up pretty well over the years. And the second is that this is our second station at 1600 on the dial today.
This is WLS AM and Stereo FM, Hartford, Beaverdam, Kentucky, and WWHK, Greenville, Central City, Kentucky.
Here's the latest from ABC News. Good morning, I'm Tim O'Donnell. She broke down and then asked for a gun to kill herself. The sheriff in Union, South Carolina, says that's what happened just before Susan Smith admitted killing her two little boys.
And that was one dreadful case that got to the roots of my psyche, too, I can tell you. Well, you know, hey, as we move along, I'm struck with the similarity of frequencies that we find in New York City, here in the middle of Kentucky. My goodness. We're going to switch now to 1050 on the dial. And the community in which we find ourselves is Central City, which is not central to much of anything as I spot the map here. But Central City, for 14 years, was the home of the Everly Brothers. Show of hands, how many... the Everly Brothers, a very famous singing group. And once their concerts came to an end, Central City set up an annual car show that draws people from Indiana, Mississippi, Alabama, all over the place.
This is WNES, Central City, Greenville.
Now, due south of Evansville, Indiana, is the town of Madisonville, Kentucky, which it's a population of about 19,000 people. And back in the year 2005, it was on the front page of many newspapers in the United States when a tornado came through and just about demolished the town. But it recovered quickly, and oh, by the way, this station is at 730 on the dial, and at night puts out 215 watts, so... You know, it could be a DX catch from down in the western portions of Kentucky.
This is America's Music Radio, WFMW, Madisonville.
CNN Radio News, I'm John Lisk. Senator Alphonse D'Amato says there's still plenty of unanswered questions about Whitewater. He's opened the latest round of hearings on the affair.
Now, this next town has a remarkable history. We've all read how the Chinese put dams in rivers. They back up the waters from that river and flood out entire towns. Well, did you know that happened in Kentucky, too? Indeed, they backed up one of the rivers feeding one of the big lakes in southwestern Kentucky and moved all the populace from this town up to higher ground. The state of Kentucky gave away all the properties that were needed, but they created the town of Eddyville, Kentucky, which is now right next to the land between the lakes. Their radio station you're about to hear is at 900 on the dial.
Music from the cathedrals, Jesus Has Risen. This is WWLK outside here in Eddyville, Kentucky. Coming up next, here's more music going out to Mr. Billy Ray Stone. This is The Hoppers with Lord, Don't Move That Mountain.
Now we can all agree that's one very pleasant voice. We're going to move along with our dials straight up at 1500.
Your kind of country, the new WMJL, AM and FM, Marion.
They say that there's a hole in the atmosphere. The things you think will last just disappear.
Now, I've just got time to get in a story about Nathan B. Stubblefield at WNBS in Murray, Kentucky, that you're about to hear. He has been credited by some authorities as the father of radio broadcasting. Well, you know, I take that to task, but nonetheless, if you ever hear about Nathan B. Stubblefield, you'll now know that he was the father of broadcasting to many people.
You're listening to AM 1340 WNBS in Murray. It's just before the hour of noon.
In this case, the defendant admits she did it. Susan Smith.
No, I don't want to hear about that again. What I do want to hear is from Mark Durenberger. Okay, we'll see you next month, everybody. And Mark, the red light's on in your studio now.
National Radio Club.
Thanks, John. Your visits to the thousands of radio towns across the country have been so valuable. I have every hope you'll continue to bring us these terrific travelogue station IDs. And I like the fact they're all from the 20th century. As broadcasting begins to assume a new face with the internet and other alternative delivery methods, it's good to stay grounded in what the AM band was once like. So keep up those terrific travelogues. This month, we return to Madison, Wisconsin, and our Wisconsin Public Radio's Randall Davidson to conclude our discussion on early radio. As you'll remember, during our interview, we talked a lot about WHA and WLBL and its early efforts, but we saved the discussion about which radio station should be credited with being first on the air. Randall's views qualify what being first really means. So let's go back to our interview, and Randall, it's good to have you here again. You had to sift through a lot of information to get there. Not only is there the demonstrable record, but there's also the fact that many station promoters tended to be self-serving, didn't they?
Many self-serving, and also the thing that I think a lot of people lose track of is that the people that were getting on the air in the earliest days were just more concerned about getting on the air, and they weren't concerned about making any kind of claim. Like, no one knew what radio was going to be used for in the early days. Right. A lot of people in the military and industry thought it would only be good for places where wired communication was impractical. Moving trains or mountaintops or ships at sea. But there was this, you know, this phenomenon of people eavesdropping. And that caused some people to think, you know, this would be a very good way to send one message to many people efficiently. The notion of broadcasting. The Navy used to broadcast the time at 10:55. I tell people this, and they're amazed to find out that in 1916, the most popular radio show in America probably was that time signal that came at 10:55 Central. That's what people tuned in for. And some other universities were experimenting with time signals and sending out weather and farm markets and news. And at the University of Wisconsin, we were early in on that process. And when the transmitters got built, the early transmitters, it was immediately, you know, what can we use it for?
One of the things that that seems to be floating around to the dismay of a lot of historians is the fact that you can look at a story about a radio station in New England or KDK in Pittsburgh, and depending on where you're looking, you get a different story.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have a problem separating fact from promotion?
Yeah. A couple things happened here. Both Detroit and Pittsburgh, KDKA, had a lot of publicity machinery behind them. They were commercial stations. Detroit was owned by a newspaper. KDK was owned by Westinghouse.
Right.
And both had a fairly big publicity machinery behind them. We're at a university, a Midwestern university. We're not in a big city, really. Madison was under 100,000 people back then. And run by scientists who were, you know, really interested in the technology rather than having lots of programming firsts.
So even though you were already likely as WHA since, I think, 1922.
1922 is when we got call letters.
You were serving the Wisconsin idea, but there are no records that can prove what you did back then. You had a bunch of firsts.
There's a lot of records. It's just that they didn't...
They didn't promote themselves.
They didn't promote themselves. There was more concern about promoting the current things, which was, you know, the School of the Air and the Farm Show and the Homemaker Show, the College of the Air, and things that were going on currently. And radio's like that anyway. I mean, they're always more concerned about tomorrow's show than yesterday's history.
Of course.
There are four claimants that are kind of in the early years. There's a half a dozen others that you can look at, but a lot of what they've said has been, most of the historians have dismissed. But the first, the big four are WHA Madison, 9XM, KCBS San Francisco.
Charles Herald Station.
Charles Herald Station. And KDKA Pittsburgh, which was 8XK. And then WWJ Detroit, which was 8MK. Those are the four that have some kind of claim as to being first. Now, but to be first, we have to define the terms. This is the thing that always trips up people. Pretty much the ancients, the academics that look at this kind of thing, they say to be first, to be radio broadcasting, it has to be by radio waves, first of all. So things that are wired don't count, even though they might be broadcasting. And there were some wired systems. After the telephone was invented, rapidly people got the idea, we can use it more point-to-point. We'll just run another line into people's homes, and they can have programming. Buenos Aires had a service. Budapest had a very popular one that ran for years. Long after radio got going, people could still take part in this telephone service. And then some businessmen from the U.S. who were in Budapest saw this. They said, well, we'll do it in the U.S. And they did it in Newark. Newark, New Jersey had a service. Had 5,000 subscribers in 1912. So there was, you know, there was this plan to do it by telephone. So, well, that doesn't count. We're talking radio. So it has to be by radio. It has to be, you know, over the air. And it has to be using radio waves. It can't be using ground induction. There were some other things that were done with ground induction. It has to be radio. It has to be also non-coded. So this lops off all the Morse code operations. It has to be something, you know,
anyone can understand.
That anybody can understand.
Yeah.
It has to be on a regular schedule. It has to have a regular program pattern to it. And it has to be for the public. So, you know, regular military transmissions or, you know, the voice transmission, they don't count. It has to be for the public, a regular schedule, by radio, uncoded. And some of the historians say it has to be licensed by the government, too. And some of them predate licensing. So we kind of can skip that one. But those four, and if you look at that, it looks pretty clear that there's a first and there's an oldest. First is first. Oldest is oldest continuous. And the first is Charles Herald. It's pretty clear, and there's good documentation that he was on the air 1909 with voice and with a regular schedule by about 1911.
Voice and music.
Voice and music.
Yeah. Okay.
And, I mean, it's pretty clear. I mean, there's a lot of good documentary evidence. In fact, a film was shot, a silent film was shot of his radio station. I saw a frame from it. His wife was a disc jockey on the station and did a show specifically for amateurs. She called the Little Hams Program. It was a music show, and people could request music.
When was this?
1912, 1913. And they had a baby, so they brought the baby in and let the baby speak on, you know, cry on the radio so people could hear what a baby sounded like over the air. And there's a picture of her holding up the baby to this giant microphone. Harold had problems with microphones, though. They kept heating up and burning out on him. These carbon microphones would get hot, and bit by bit, the show would get mushier and mushier sounding, then quit altogether. He eventually developed a water-cooled microphone. What keeps him from being the oldest, he was ordered off the air like everybody else in World War I. He made an appeal to the government. He says, I'll offer my station to government use. And they said no. So he was off the air during the war. And he didn't get on after the war as quick as possible. There was a big gap there. The records are real fuzzy about when he was back on. And by this time, he had licenses. 6XF and 6XE were his licenses. Mm-hmm. And so he got back on the air, you know, and became KQW, I think were the call letters. And then that became KCBS, San Francisco. Mm-hmm. But Harold held the license through the 20s. So he has this license record, too, which is very good. But he had a regular schedule. He was at the San Francisco Exposition in 1915. And actually, Lee DeForest was there to demonstrate his equipment, and his transmitter didn't work, so he was using these regular broadcasts from San Jose.
That sounds like Lee DeForest.
You know? And so there was, DeForest was well aware that this guy was on the air in 1915.
Sure.
So,
WWJ.
Yeah, but of course, he's a WWJ acolyte because he, of course, they were using a DeForest brand transmitter. So there's a little, you know, you have to wonder how strong their claim is. KDKA has an early history that parallels WHA's because they were on before the war. Mm-hmm. Dr. Conrad, Frank Conrad, had built a transmitter and receiving equipment to settle a bet about how accurate his watch was. And then he started broadcasting from his home, Morse code, and then he played a record one night. He got so many requests, they said he'd be on two nights a week playing records. And he rigged a deal with a record store to borrow records, kind of an underwriter, sponsor almost. It's pretty clear that his regular schedule started in October 1919. And his garage kind of looked like a radio station. I mean, they were doing some spoken word things. They were in live music. He was doing announcing. He was playing records. He had a sponsor, a record store, that offered him records in exchange for a mention. So pretty clear. And then the story is well known that, you know, a local store started selling radios for people that wanted to hear these concerts mm-hmm. that he was putting on, these record shows. And that gave Westinghouse the idea, maybe we could do this. Can we get one on the air in time for the election? In 20. So they went on in 1920, and that's pretty clear. Detroit's claim is really fuzzy because the station that supposedly was on the air in 1920 with election materials in August of that year, the licensee, the connection between them and the eventual licensee of WWJ is real fuzzy. And most of the historians dismiss that claim.
Didn't they, though, claim that they were doing election results in 1916?
I never found that.
It might have been
Morse code too.
Yeah, probably.
So we're talking spoken word.
No,
materials.
You're right.
And but, so those are the other claimants. KDKA, I'm pretty happy to say, is the oldest station in America that's been
run by your definition. Right.
By these definitions,
yep. And the first.
And I'm happy to say KCBS, the Charles Herald station, was probably pretty clearly the first. Where WHA comes into the scheme here, 9XM. We know for sure had a regular schedule that meets this standard January 3rd, 1921. So that's about 7 weeks after KDKA. Now, also, XWA was in there from Montreal on 2 days after KDKA. But the thing that that WHA, I found a couple records, our first operator told his successor, another student operator, he always lamented that WHA missed being the first station by 5 days. And he said specifically, by 5 days. And that would put it at November 7th, 1920, which was a Saturday. And in the early, early years of the station was on with voice broadcasting, playing records essentially, music with sound broadcasting, on Saturday nights and early Sunday morning for testing purposes. But the student felt that that was, since that was a regular sound broadcast and people knew about it, it was for the public for testing their receiving equipment, he regarded that as rising to that level of regularly scheduled. Now, Earl Terry, of course, he wasn't a night owl. He was well known to not stay up late at night. He always said, no, January 21 was when we went on the air. And that's what all the other documentary evidence points to. But our historical marker says January 3rd, 1919. What they did is they took the January 3rd from the 1921 records and cobbled it onto the 1919 experimental sound broadcast in the evening and put that as our first broadcast date. And that has echoed through all kinds of documents, I think incorrectly. Mm-hmm. So I'm plenty happy. It looks like we're second to KDK, maybe by only 5 days, maybe as much by 7 weeks, but we are early, early there.
You are also the earliest non-commercial station.
Of the ones that are still operating,
we're clearly the
only educational one that's still going that's that old. The same day we got the WHA call letters, WLB in Minneapolis, the University of Minnesota got theirs.
KUOM?
Yeah, they're now KUOM. Yeah. And they are also, very interestingly, those two stations were the first to be licensed in the new limited commercial category that became the standard broadcast license in the 20s.
1922, about, right?
January 22 is when the license went into effect. We got it in late 21. Right. And so that was kind of the thing. So my view is I'm plenty happy to make this claim. I'm very comfortable with this claim. It doesn't bother me that we're not the first or the oldest, that we have so much to be proud of here.
You do indeed, and WHA remains a shining example of the pioneer radio spirit. Thank you, Randall Davidson. Mark Dernberger for the DX Audio Service. And as long as we've reopened the discussion of firsts and how early radio grew, this is a good time to tell you that we'll soon be starting two series on the development of radio stations. First, from the perspective of how many of the pioneer radio stations served their constituents and developed their services. And we'll go station by station in presenting these case histories. And then as a second approach, we're going to go by frequency, explaining when each of the Clear Channel frequencies was assigned and what stations occupied those channels over the years. And as we know, there were many, many changes. I suspect this is going to be a lot of work, and we'll present a good deal of detail in a multiple-part series, and we hope you'll find it useful. Until we meet again in 30 days, good listening, DXers.
Just a reminder that effective with the last issue, we're making a change in the due date of your DX audio service. In the past, we've had it on the 10th of the month. That was based on the production of the DX audio service being on the preceding 20th of the month and then usually out the door within a week. Effective with our last issue, the DX audio service tapes are not due until the last day of the month of the issue. Now, what this means is the October 2008 tape is not due to be in your possession until Friday, October the 31st. The November tape is not due to be in your possession until Monday, December 1st, since there is no mail delivery on Sunday. Now, normally you should see your tape at the beginning of the month, and I think traditionally we've always had the tapes to you by the 10th of the month. However, there have been a few times when we've had delays in mailing, and we're simply getting far too many requests for replacement tapes based on that hard 10th of the month date. By the way, requests for replacements should be in writing. Telephone calls asking for replacements will be ignored. And if you ask another member or editor for a new tape, keep in mind that you're asking them for the tape and not us. Before we flip over to side two of the tape, I'd just like to pass along some information about something that happened at the 2008 National Radio Club Convention. A couple of members approached me about putting together a membership certificate which would look like a radio license, and this is kind of like what Popular Communications did in the 60s with their old WPE call signs. So in other words, a member would not only have their name on the certificate, but they would be issued a call sign for their DXing, so to speak, and we just have to come up with some kind of criteria for how you would get that license. So we're kind of mulling that over and seeing how that might work. If you have some comments to make on that, you might want to drop them on a card or a letter to me, or perhaps an email to sales@nrcdxas.org. Also, we're looking for an editor for a column which was suggested called Where Are They Now? A look at what happened to some of the people that were in radio. So if you would like to become an editor for the DX Audio Service and put on that column, what you need to do is contact me. And my information is at the start of the tape. And we're looking to do stories on people such as these.
You're listening to the solid gold sound of $1 Million Weekend. All weekend from
WUBE Cincinnati.
It's 10:31. This is Buona Johnny.
Johnny Knox High School Countdown.
Johnny Knox.
Wonderful WQAM.
3 minutes after 9 o'clock, WQAM. It is cool outside, about 56 degrees now for Miami. These are the classics for an old spooky.
And you're invited to come on out and have a lot of fun. This is Gary Corey here until 6 o'clock in Place and Miles. And Dick Provo swings from 6 to midnight tonight on the Fun Spot.
WCPO.
So proud. These are the impressions.
Where the Boys Are, brand new song by Connie Francis from the Tomlin Show on WDGY. It's 11 minutes now after 8 o'clock.
Oh, I feel like an angel today. 610 KFRC, that is Lady Madonna. I'm rocking Rennell Lewis. It's 5:36 as we're getting close now. The countdown is going to begin. The last few hours of rock and roll on the Big 610. 610 KFRC.